Well, good evening. My name's Stephen Satchell. I'm also an economist. You've had rather a number of us tonight. I first have to address Martin Wheel's notion that economists are famous for their narrow minds. And since we're actually dealing with utility tonight, it's not at all clear whether the utility function of an economist is increasing in narrowness or decreasing. I think it depends on the institution. Now, moving on from there, I also note that I'm an actuary, an honorary actuary, which I'm very proud of, and I've worn my actuarial tie tonight, and I noticed that nobody else is wearing the same tie. So I just wonder quite what you've signed me up for. Now, on to background risks. Professor Peredin did address the issue as to really one of definition, and I think it's an interesting point because it's one that needs to be clarified. It's quite clear that any background risk that can be quantified can be insured or a derivative contract to be written on it. So it's not really that's the issue. I guess what it is whether the underlying entity represents something that's tradable. And that's how I would think of it. That may not be right, but that's why I've tended to analyze it in problems. In terms of background risks themselves, background risks have been, in this context, either actuarially fair in terms of the sort of utility analysis, meaning that on average their mean is zero, if you like, and because of risk aversion, therefore they are bads. But one can think of background risks that are goods. So, for example, consumer confidence I would regard as a background risk. You can't trade it. Yet, nevertheless, when it's up, that's generally good for utility, and it's not necessarily mean zero either. How should we model it? Well, one of the criticisms made against background risk, which is one I feel uncomfortable about as well, is the fact that when you read papers on it, as this evening's paper is, utility functions tend to be a bit bespoke. You have a problem, you build a utility function that addresses that problem. There isn't really a general framework, and one's always worried how sensitive the results are to the way in which you've specified utility. And that's, of course, a concern. And so what one wants to do really is look at a more general framework to address this. Now, in Campbell, Lowe and McKinley's book on financial econometrics, I can't give you the chapter reference, I didn't bring it with me, but there's a section which I think is rather good where they essentially look at the impact on the risk premium of what are essentially, or what could be regarded as background risks. The framework is something like a Cobb-Douglas utility, rather like tonight, and where the joint distribution of equity, consumption, or the financial assets consumption, the background risks is multivariate log normal or something of that sort. Now that leads to a relatively tractable situation where you can actually quantify the impact on, say, the risk premium of equity of something like consumer confidence. And I have a PhD student who's been doing this, and it indeed seems to give very sensible results. Finally, how should we deal with all these uncertainties? There are many others than the ones mentioned. You could regard background risk to some extent as involving things like model uncertainty, parameter uncertainty. These are all things you can't trade. They all affect the expected utility decision when you get down to analyze it. And, of course, the popular resolution of this, certainly in the fund management sector, is to look at things like robust optimization. Because if you think about asset allocation is whether we would like to think of it this way, in some sense, the solution to an optimization problem. And robust techniques give some promise of being able to bring into play some of the uncertainties associated with their inputs. Well, thank you for the paper. That's it.
Cliff Speed, Hewitt Associates. Thank you very much for a well-researched paper which brings to the attention of actuaries considerable literature on background risks and also some of the work upon preference theory. I'd like to agree with previous speakers who talked about the relative materiality of background risks and tradable risks and also the importance of where we do have tradable risks of convergence between actuarial methodology and market prices. But as we move on to look at background risks, I also want to consider the materiality they have to pensions. The liability for a pension scheme, to my mind, is the accrued liability based upon the current salary. In other words, wage and labour market risk does not appear. Now, in the past, we've had the argument that, well, yeah, you may have that, but in practice, actuaries talk about projected earnings. So we do it from a practical point of view. But consider the current environment. We know that the debt on the employer, if they walk away from the scheme, are the accrued liabilities. We've also had the pensions regulator telling us that the triggers for funding targets are going to be based upon accrued liabilities, i.e. with no future salary. So I think there's a strong theoretical and practical argument for just looking at liabilities today without future earnings growth. So to my mind, the paper is left to address as demographic risk, in particular mortality. But even here, we have a partial buyout market, and there's the possibility of reinsurance and maybe even capital market products. But the one big background risk, which I'd like to see more about, is the background risk that employees have of their company going bust, which they cannot hedge. In section 4, we find the justification of the approach to all the subsequent modelling. And while a lot of the financial literature applies to pension scheme, the corporate structure, where trustees and corporate managers are agents acting for principals, this framework is rejected. Instead, we have a game theoretic approach, where objective functions are used and applied to the pension fund. Now, let's think about this. We're using objective functions not only for groups of individuals who may have very different financial backgrounds, but also these two groups of individuals, if we're looking at shareholders and members, may at times have very divergent interests. This is a hard task for an objective function. Okay? The particular objective function used considers the deficit and the inflows to the pension scheme, where large inflows have seemed undesirable. Now, in section 4.2, we have the assertion that trustees do not want to have sudden jumps in the financing required by the plan. Well, my reaction to that is, why not? A sudden jump from 60% to 90% funded seems totally consistent with the fiduciary duty of the trustees to pay the benefit and deliver greater security to members. The approach also has the potential for giving rise to somewhat confusing results. So, when we look at 6.2.3, we're told the optimal funding goes up from 51.71% to 52.26%. And I'm left wondering, is this really optimal? Again, think from a member's point of view. We're being told that if a scheme is 51% funded, the remaining 49% is essentially of that pension promise is essentially invested in a non-diversified, unsecured, long-term loan to the sponsor. There are little or no loan covenants, and the repayment schedule is ill-defined. Is this really optimal? I struggle to believe. We're also shown in 7.1 that for many values of the risk aversion parameter gamma, 100% equities is optimal, even without background risks, despite the acknowledgement that pension fund liabilities are bond-like. And I'm left with a question. What happens if in this game setup, there's an important player who's been missed? And if we had this important player, there would be an optimal strategy where the two key players we are looking at could work together at the expense of this third player. Well, that seems to me like the situation we actually have. Because the tax arbitrage approach, as advocated by Black and Tepper, is totally missing from this. And so when we remove background risk, we don't get back to the 100% bond strategy that has been advocated. In short, I think this is a great paper for bringing to the attention background risks, and that actuaries should be aware of them. But I think, at current times, probably the interaction of capital structure and tax effects are more important. Whereas a welcome bringing background risk to the fore and having people thinking about it, I still have concerns about the particular framework the authors have chosen to present them in this paper. But thank you for an excellent paper nonetheless.
Other speakers? Yes. Christopher.
I'll maintain the informality of the evening. I was interested in the discussion, particularly around the kinked chart that that was put up earlier, and the relative utility of surplus versus the discomfort of deficiency. And it did strike me at that point that such a huge amount has happened in the evolution of pensions in the last 10 or 15 years that that area deserves a lot more research and exploration. So, for example, if you went back to the 1980s, pension funds were indeed in surplus. That utility function was completely different. It's true that employers took advantage of contribution holidays, but normally the trade-off for that was benefit improvements for the members, and the trustees, I think, often regarded themselves as having a duty to negotiate benefit improvements for the members in return for the contribution holidays. So the interests of the different parties were very different. They were also very different in the impact of potential deficiencies, not that many funds had them in the 1980s, because the accounting treatment was different and employers were in a position to fund them away in a way that didn't cause enormous volatility in their financial reporting. So when you go back in time, the utility of surplus to deficiency was very different from what it currently is. And when you also go forwards in time, everyone at the moment is figuring out what impact the new regulations have. And every trustee and every sponsoring employer on the land is figuring out where that balance is going to be struck as to what the funding strategy should be. So I think this is going to change again from where it's been more recently. I think one of the interesting areas that for me in how pensions have evolved in this country is that we've got ourselves into a position where ideally employers should be able to renegotiate their liabilities and then fund them on a completely different strategy from that which they embarked on historically. In other words, when all of these final salary liabilities were originated, funding strategies that were acceptable were very different, and we've moved into a different era in terms of what's regarded as appropriate, not just because of accounting standards, but perhaps because of greater awareness of some of the risks that are actually involved. Now, Gordon Brown at the CBI conference earlier today said that we should avoid gold plating regulations, and he was looking for suggestions of things that we should not gold plate. And I think, without realising it, we did gold plate pension fund regulations when we introduced the pension increase legislation. And when you compare Britain now with all the other European countries, there isn't anywhere else that's got the same level of guarantee attached to pensions in payment in terms of inflation protection. And in a way, that's what's causing us a lot of the difficulties. One of the nearest examples of countries with big pension funds is the Dutch. And there they have a concept that if the funding won't support full inflation proofing of the pensions, then a business plan is agreed with the regulator for restoration of full funding. And until it is restored, then the pension increases are cut back so that the pensioners share some of the pain. And I think if we were able to rewrite history, and that's the one bit of legislation that I would go back and revisit, because I think that's the one that's really tied us up in knots. I'd like to just finish with a question for the authors to deal with when they come back at the end, which is one thing that I wasn't left very clear about in the paper was what conclusions this led to, or whether they felt that they needed to do more work before reaching conclusions on the extent to which it's worth hedging hedgeable risks in the presence of unhedgeable risks. I also do think we should rename this paper now Unhedgeable Risks rather than Background Risk, because clearly mortality is more than a background risk, and the real issue is whether or not you can hedge all of the risks involved in pensions.
Rowe from Hewitt Associates as well. A few unconnected remarks. Firstly, about the kink in the utility function. I want to agree or disagree with Martin and agree with other speakers that from an individual point of view, I'm sure there is a kink. And as proof of that, I went to a lecture on happiness at the Royal Institution. And a lot of economists and social scientists and psychologists have been working together to look at this. And essentially, people's happiness, you get used to a certain way of living, and you get very unhappy if something happens to bring you down from that. And you get slightly more happy when things improve, but then you rapidly get used to that. As an example, they said that when you get married, there's a peak on your wedding day that you're really, really happy. And about 2 years afterwards, you may be still slightly better than if you were just single, but there's not really that much in it. I'm 5 years married, so I'm thinking maybe I'm just a bit slower going down the curve. But I just thought I'd add that as a thing that they did say in the lecture, that actually economists don't tend to recognise this, and it's common sense to everyone else. So perhaps I can pass that on. Moving on to companies and how they feel about their deficits. The one thing the paper didn't pick up, I felt, was that there's a correlation or perhaps a connection between how the trustees and the sponsor feel about their deficit with what the average deficits are in the rest of UK PLC. I've been to quite a few things where the trustees, although they've got a deficit, they're definitely not as unhappy as they would be if they had a deficit and everyone else had a surplus. But the company comforts them by saying, well, our scheme's not much worse than everyone else. You know, everyone's had these same problems. And they manage to make their members a bit happier than they would otherwise be as well. So it's certainly not a case that we're advising a fund which is viewed completely in isolation of everything else. I'm not quite sure what that means in terms of the advice we give. Maybe it just means that we're let off the hook when we get funds into deficit. I've completely forgotten what my third point was, but anyway, I'll end up by saying thank you very much for the paper.
Right, well, I'm making a living and I've been married 33 years, so whether that makes me happy or not, you can work out for yourselves. But have we any other speakers? Yes?
Martin White, one very quick point on hedging. Most capital that's owned is owned in one way or the other on behalf of people who are going to retire. And the extent to which defined benefit funds are hedging, I think the defined contribution concept is the other side of the hedge.
Any others? If there aren't any, I'll call upon David Bowie to close the discussion.
Mr. Vice President, ladies and gentlemen, I would of course like to start by joining all the previous contributors and thanking Mike Mirko and their co-authors for a great paper. It's clearly involved a lot of very detailed work. In trying to sort of put together some closing remarks, I've taken the authors' kind of recommendations at the back of their slide there, and just want to echo those back to you a little bit. Their intentions were, I think, to put background risks more firmly in our thinking about risk management of pension funds. The second one was to consider funding and investment strategies kind of jointly. And the third sort of objective seemed to be to encourage us to spend more time thinking about decision-making frameworks, if I understand it correctly, for pension schemes and for the stakeholders. I certainly don't think I've heard any objections at all to the first couple of those objectives. I think most of the comments and discussion anyway has focused on that third one, about how the decision-making process perhaps unfolds. And I suppose a lot of that sort of stems back to the way in which the pensions, or thinking about pensions within the profession, has evolved over the last several years. And I guess it sort of spits into the usual two camps of the more scheme-centric equity equals lower cost type of camp, and on the other side the so-called FE approach, or that's what the authors call it anyway. And in particular, the authors claim that this FE approach is flawed because of background risks, and that makes the market incomplete. And so some way of deciding between valuation methodologies and negotiation has to be found. And the authors choose to deal with that incompleteness by specifying, as so many speakers have pointed out, a single sort of bargaining objective. And that kind of embeds it, I think, largely in the scheme-centric type of mould. And we've clearly got quite a number of members in the audience who found kinked utility curves really exciting. I think I'd mention just about everybody who linked some sort of discussion about the way in which decision making might or should take place back to that kind of kinked utility curve. Clearly, that example has drawn an excellent chord with a lot of people. Andrew Smith, in particular, contrasted, I think, and several speakers following up, contrasted the idea of having lots of different stakeholders, each with their own utility functions, negotiating to arrive at some sort of outcome, and contrasted that with the specifying some sort of single objective function which could be found. I think Joao Coco also brought up those, also spent quite a lot of time, in fact, discussing kind of the features and the way in which the kinked utility curve might function. So in placing this paper, I think kind of as a branch of kind of the scheme-centric approach, I don't see that it has no application within an FE approach. Indeed, there are quite clear parallels. And I think I've got later on a comment about, I found it slightly odd, in fact, that in the examples which the authors drew, when they took away all the background risks, they didn't end up with the all bonds and full funding type of answer, which is what you'd expect if all the rest of the FE stuff held true. In terms of the rest of my comments, I've sort of brought them together under three themes. One, just generally the paper on background risks at all being brought to this audience. A second one, kind of the modelling pension framework. I've already discussed that a little bit. And then the model itself, about which, in fact, there was no contention. Everybody agreed with the answers. I'm certainly on common ground, I think, with all the speakers in thanking the authors for bringing background risks to the fore. And it adds a lot to the other papers that have already been published, not necessarily discussed here, on second-order effects such as tax and default insurance and sponsor covenants and risk sharing between the different stakeholders. I think one of the key things it does do for us is it draws together a literature that we're perhaps not that au fait with at all, in particular the economics literature, which is supposedly so narrow, and gives us a bit of context for a lot of the actuarial views that we take, in particular the holder reserve type of reaction to any sort of unknown risks. Well, although that's precautionary saving, I believe. Martin Wheel and Andrew Smith both suggested that there were perhaps some other risks which should be taken into account, and I guess I'm going to class those generally as agency risks, the disconnect between trustees and members, between management and shareholders, etc. Martin Wheel kind of teased us a little bit about background risks with the solution to the pensions problem and introducing the Black Death again, but he pointed out that perhaps that wasn't a risk which worked independently of all the economic conditions. Certainly the framework in which the modelling takes place is a lot more subjective. As I've mentioned before, I was surprised that the FE approach didn't appear as a solution when there were no background risks, given that the authors specifically said that was the problem with the FE approach. And I think Cliff Speed, David McCarthy and others have also mentioned that some of the most important second order effects, kind of non-hedgeable type risks, although I suppose they are hedgeable in some sense, would be the tax and sponsor covenant issues. But I think the authors might envisage that these are built in indirectly through the parameters in their objective function, but perhaps they could follow up on that. Cliff Speed certainly specifically suggested that removing wage risk as a background risk because it simply wasn't relevant to the value of the pensions being considered. Perhaps a more fundamental issue, though, well, that can't be dealt with so easily within the framework is the treatment of funding. I took from the paper that the model placed a lot of focus on the timing of contributions into the scheme rather than on the timing of the accrual of the benefits. And of course, both of them do feed through to the objective function in the sense that there's a deficit bit and the funding bit. But certainly in 4, 5, 10, the author specifically suggests that it's the timing of the cash flow rather than the accrual which changes the economic position. And I would suggest that's not an entirely... I would be interested in their comments on that because I don't think it's an entirely universally agreed with way of doing things. Clearly, putting money into the pension fund does cost the sponsor something, as Martin Wheelford, for example, concluded. But I think it's different from the cost of the benefit accruing, the economic cost. The points were mentioned about the sponsor losing the control of the use of the money, the flexibility. The sponsor, of course, loses the option to default and bankruptcy if there's no if that money's already in the scheme. And of course, there may be other kind of subtler influences, the squeeze in liquidity, financing costs, perhaps in the real world, which may it have to pass up in some business opportunities. On the other hand, Cliff Speed mentioned the fact that there may be huge tax advantages to having a fully funded scheme, and particularly for strong sponsors, the fact that they have the liability, whether they keep that money in the fund or not, is probably not going to change their value terribly much. And having a fully funded scheme in terms of the softer issues that some people mentioned, it means that they don't have to have all the hassle of going through clearance procedures if they've got a fully funded pension scheme, and they don't have to spend time negotiating with trustees. I have another question for the authors in terms of their model formulation, and it's down to the objective function. I don't know an awful lot about the Cobb-Douglas model, but my understanding of it is that it's much more of a descriptive type of process rather than a normative, this is how you should go about negotiating type of process. In other words, it describes the outcome of negotiation rather than the way in which you do that. And in that context, I thought this paper probably could have said an awful lot more in Section 8 on the establishing the fair value, which is the outcome of a negotiation, far more perhaps than on how pension funds should be funded and invested. Cliff Speed, I think, also mentioned that underfunding is the equivalent of a concentrated equity investment. And if indeed it can be interpreted that way, then reducing funding can be seen as increasing asset risk, and I wondered how all that fell through within the objective function that you'd specified. I suppose it depends very much on how the sponsor will share business success with the members of the pension scheme, perhaps through enhanced benefits or bigger wages, but I'm a wishful thinker. In terms of the details in the model, certainly Andrew Smith and others made comments about how unstable, in fact, the results seem to be, and indeed the authors bring up that very point themselves by suggesting that the calibration and the choice of the model are absolutely critical to any conclusions that you might reach. The inference I drew from the paper was that either that this arena is intrinsically completely unstable and the way in which pension funds should be funded or invested seem to swing from one side to the other completely, or indeed the modelling framework as a whole doesn't particularly help or give us a great insight into this area. William Peredin, Cliff Speed, Stephen Satchell all mentioned that a lot more research needs to go into and a lot more understanding needs to go into the nature of the different types of risks, kind of the hedgeable equity type risks versus the background risks. And I'd also further point out that some of the background risks are quite different in that you don't actually know that they've happened until some time after the event, which would be interesting to try and build into the model. As a profession, in concluding here, I think we need to be careful, and William Peredin made this point particularly, we need to be careful not to be seen to be trying to kind of, I don't know, sneak in equity under some big sort of fluffy duvet of background risks. You know, we have to acknowledge the fact that there were and are hedgeable risks out there, and at least we should have a full understanding of those and what can be done about them. before we spend too much time, or before we get too sort of misdirected with the unhedgeable risks, perhaps. I think we also need to be really careful in reacting to background risks and not taking the modelling in terms of the increasing equity type conclusion too seriously. And that it would seem pretty odd from a public interest perspective if what you did when you came across a situation with a lot of risk for individual members was stick in some more risks in the sense of equity risk, certainly from the members' perspective. It is, though, clear that there's a lot of support. Martin Wheel, William Peridon suggested that holding reserves, acknowledging the difference between the insurance value and the pensions value on all the liabilities, is something we should take seriously. And holding a reserve over and above kind of full solvency is a way forward. It's something that shouldn't be ignored and didn't seem to come through, I don't think, particularly in the modelling. We could do with a lot more investigation on background risks. I think the view perhaps should be more in terms of risk management than just accepting what they are. And Jacques Coco, for example, suggested that we could explore other asset classes to try and develop hedges or at least partial hedges against some of these issues. And we need to sort of improve the chances of understanding when and how background risks might emerge. And I think to the extent that this paper has brought all those issues to a head and enabled us to discuss them, I think it's made an important contribution to our understanding on pension funds. And I'd like to conclude by thanking the authors once again for an excellent paper.
And I now invite the authors to respond.
I realize at the moment I'm the only one standing between us and the wine reception, and I'm quite keen to speak quickly. I understand we have a chance to write a detailed response to the excellent points that have come up, and we will do that. I want to focus briefly on three points. First is kinks. Kinks are actually only two paragraphs in the paper, 4.41 and 4.42, and I've been quite surprised in the interest in kinks. It was just an example, but there are regulatory rules in the U.S. on funding, maybe on the PPF, in terms of contributions that are required that could induce kinks in objective functions. 100% funding is perhaps a reasonable kink for someone who is very close to retirement because they're less likely to get benefits that are above 100%. But, I mean, you can take issue with that. It was just an example to motivate the idea that asset allocation is affected by background risk. Models. There have been a number of comments on models, and one reason we presented different models was to try to just show what could happen in different settings. In terms of the issue about why, without background risk, there wasn't 100% bond investment, there are two answers to that. First is, you could think of these models as models with a bit of background risk and then models with a lot more background risk. And second, it's not clear in the basic financial theory that you should be 100% in bonds or 100% fully funded until you take into account other considerations such as tax. If you go back over the literature, there with tax considerations and the tax shield, 100% bonds, but with PPF-type liabilities, you can be 100% equity, and there's a knife edge between the two. In competitive financial theory, there's no reason any asset allocation, and this goes back to the Exley-Meta-Smith paper, it's considerations like tax which lead you to 100% bonds, consideration like member protection that lead you to 100% bonds, and there are economic models out there that justify underfunding. For instance, firms don't want to have fully funded pensions because they can lead to workers demanding too high of a wage increase. So there's a big literature in this area, and we could have easily calibrated to be 100% bonds. In terms of the comment on 1 to 2 year horizon, it's really a two-period time horizon. The periods could be quite long. And there are a lot of other detailed comments which we'll respond to. I think the important point is that we considered in a number of different models. One of them did have a game theory approach, which is commonly used in labor economics, which is my background. But you could consider much more complicated models, and you could have dynamic models. Sections 4.8.1 to 4.8.4 consider briefly the implications of dynamic models relating decisions about pensions to individual decisions about asset allocation given their human capital. And I think the points made about considering things outside the pension plan are very important ones. Very important ones. Last point, magnitude of risks. This is a very important point, and I think that the magnitude of risks has varied over time, and it could becoming more important going forward because of the more mature nature of schemes. It's clearly something that needs more measurement and more careful consideration. I think we have to be careful to avoid overemphasizing risk in the things we do, because I think the biggest issue is underfunding. The biggest loss to members' welfare is the fact that pension schemes aren't funded. If you take an underfunded scheme and you put it all in bonds, you do improve members' welfare, but do you improve it that much compared to a situation where you put more money in the scheme? So I would argue that that yes, there is an issue about magnitude of risk, but the mere existence of background risks suggests, to me at least, that we need to pay more attention to funding, which is the main problem affecting members today. Thank you very much for all your excellent comments and contributions.
Well, the subject of non-hedgeable risks, as Andrew Smith pointed out, has been much discussed over the last five or six years in the insurance area, and we've had big discussions in this hall on such matters as the allowance for risks in market-consistent embedded values earlier on this year. We've had the International Accounting Standards Board's insurance project, where for both life and general insurance, we've discussed the appropriateness or otherwise of including market value margins for non-hedgeable risk. And purely for general insurance, some years ago we had a big discussion on reinsurance to close at Lloyd's, where again one of the biggest issues was the treatment of non-hedgeable risk. I would put in a strong plea, which was echoed by Paul Thornton, that we don't try and introduce new terminology for what is essentially the same thing, and I hope we can move away from talking about background risk. Within pensions, we've been talking tonight largely about funding, but as a non-pensions practitioner, I can see that maybe if the accounting bodies are so keen on risk margins in the insurance field, there's no real logic for them not wanting to see such margins in accounting liabilities for defined benefit pension schemes. And then, of course, there's the thorny question of cash equivalents and whether they should be increased or possibly even reduced for the existence of non-hedgeable risks. All this has led to a lively discussion tonight, and I'd like to add my own thanks to the authors, and also for the opener and closer and all those who took part in this evening's discussion. And thank them again in the normal way, please. Now, it would be very helpful for those preparing the transcript of the discussion for the British Actuarial Journal if those of you who spoke from prepared notes could hand them to either Pauline Simpson or Maria Lyons as you leave. And also, I've also been asked to draw your attention to the bulletin board that's been set up on the profession's website, which is available after each session or meeting. And anyone wishing to comment on the paper or elements of the discussion may post their comments there. The bulletin can be accessed via the forum heading on the top navigation bar as you enter the website. Now, the next meeting of the Institute of Actuaries will take place on Monday, the 23rd of January, 2006, when a discussion on a subject that possibly closely related to some of the issues that have been raised tonight, on the cost of capital for financial firms will take place. And that meeting will revert to the standard time of 5 p.m. Now, I invite you to join me. We're taking a drink at the expense of Watson Wyatt, kindly provided drinks at the back of the hall. And in the hall, you may like to know that a buzz-off, so I'm told it's called, for the to decide our team next year in University Challenge the Professionals. That's taking place at 7:30 in this hall. So if you're still drinking by then, I'm told you're very welcome to come in and with a drink and watch the proceedings. But if you could, please avoid wandering in and out. So with that, I declare the formal part of this evening's proceedings closed.